Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Well, as you've heard by now, Donald and Melania Trump are quarantining. Trump tweeted last night that they both tested positive for COVID. The news comes just hours after we learned that Trump's political advisor, Hope Hicks, tested positive. There are a lot of questions that remain. How did Hope Hicks get it? How did Donald Trump get it? When did he know she had it? According to reports, Hope Hicks tested positive on Wednesday, but the White House did not inform reporters. Bloomberg broke the story last night. Donald Trump attended a fundraiser yesterday in Bedminster, New Jersey, and according to CNBC, donors who paid up to $250,000 to attend are, quote, freaking out. Another important question is, did Donald Trump have it during Tuesday's debate when he was constantly talking and shouting? According to reports this morning, Joe and Jill Biden tested negative. At the debate, Biden's people were wearing masks. Trump's people were not. Also this morning, we learned that Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has also tested positive. He was with Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett on Tuesday. They were indoors without masks. According to report, Barrett tested negative. Well, all of this comes just a week after the New York Times ran an explosive investigation revealing that Trump paid just $750 in federal income taxes in 2016 and 2017 and no federal income tax in 10 out of the last 15 years. Today's guest, David K. Johnston, has been covering this for many years. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter and the author of many best-selling books, including his most recent, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David K. Johnston is the founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service, DC Report. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Rose. I hope you're doing okay with the unbelievably bad air in the city of my birth.
Oh, thank you. It is pretty bad, unfortunately, this morning. And David, there's so much going on. Where do we even begin? I mean, I think throughout the day, we will be getting test results from a number of high-profile people.
We are, but can I start us off with a happy note?
Oh, please.
The news came out last night that in Norway, where some of my ancestors come from, last month, electric vehicles were 82% of all the cars sold.
82%. Wow.
Yeah, they're the leader in the world, and that's a good thing for us, our planet, our progeny, 82%.
How much?
And it's an oil country. Norway's a big oil country.
How much do electric cars cost in Norway?
Apparently not like they do here, although European cars are hard to compare. I mean, for example, a Mercedes-Benz that costs $60,000 here may be the equivalent of $45,000 or so, for reasons to deal with American safety rules and other things.
Wow, that's incredible.
But the number of car sales has been steady. It's that the Norwegians earlier went over 50% and then 60%, and last month 82%. That old line from the West Wing, not the West Wing, from the American President, the Aaron Sorkin film about your Volvo is going to be a museum relic in 20 years, and he's finally starting to become true 25 or 30 years later.
Well, that's incredible. Thank you for that good news, David. In fact,
yeah.
Once the election is over, we're going to do a whole series, many, many weeks, on positive stories and solutions. So we will definitely look into that.
I took you off track about
fine.
Which aspect of this multifaceted story you want to go at.
So, I mean, there's so much here, David, so many unanswered questions. Like I said, we'll definitely be getting test results throughout the day from high-profile people.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people around Trump are going to test themselves. Joe Biden's campaign just announced that he and his wife, Jill, have tested negative. I frankly am kind of surprised it's taken this long for Trump to be infected, even as you've seen him, you know, stand back from people and chastise a journalist who approached him, but want people to come to his rallies, or as he now likes to call them, protests, with no masks. But that goes to the nature of Donald, which is he doesn't care about you. He cares only about himself. You are an object. You can be used. You can be abused. You can be cast away. But you're not a person. You're just an object. And I have a piece that just went up at Raw Story and will be at DC Report tomorrow saying that, you know, we should not lower ourselves to Trump's level. No matter what the temptation, if you do not like the man, you should not wish that he will die. And the reasons for doing that are partly about your own moral character and being better than Trump. But also, I believe that if Donald Trump is either ailing or dead on November 3rd, it will not be good for our democracy to endure. We need a clean referendum rejecting him. He should lose by 16 million votes and could well lose by more than 20 million votes. And if he's sick or ailing, we'll never get a referendum on him, and there'll never be an opportunity for the state of New York to indict, try, and convict him for crimes he's committed going back to 2011.
David, where are you getting that 15 million number? I saw you tweet it.
Well, Trump lost the popular vote in 2012 by 11 million votes. That's the Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes, and then there were almost 8 million votes that went to the two minor party candidates, Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, the Libertarian and the Green Party candidate. Then you look at the 2018 elections in which the Democrats did very well. And I mean, it's my back-of-the-envelope estimate, but I'm sure he'll win by at least 16 million votes. I mean, lose by at least that much. I think it's possible it'll be higher. We're seeing record numbers of voter registrations in a number of places despite all of the suppression of votes. Remember what Trump himself said, Rose, not too long ago, that if we had universal mail-in voting, no Republican would ever be elected again. Because I'm not arguing for a one-party country. I do not want to live in a one-party country, no matter what party it is. But the reality is the Republican Party has worked for years to suppress the vote because it is out of tune with the American public.
David, did we lose you?
I hope not.
Oh, nope, you're there.
Okay.
Well, and also, David, you know, one more question about COVID. I mean, we've been covering this and the science since February. How do you think this is going to change the media coverage and the way that the government now talks about COVID, given that Trump and Donald and Melania Trump have it? Mike Lee is positive. He was with Amy Coney Barrett on Tuesday indoors without masks. All of Trump's people at the debate refused to take masks and wear them.
Well, even as a man in his 70s, as I am also, Trump still has an 80% chance of surviving this. We are learning that there are, for many people, long-term heart, other organ and brain issues that turn up. But in all likelihood, he will come out of this soon. And I think at that point, he's going to say, see, it's no big deal, which is not true. And that would be the downside to his having contracted COVID. As for how we cover this in the news, you know, I've been back reading front pages and other articles of newspapers from the 1918 to 1920 wrongly named Spanish flu pandemic, you know, the one that killed Donald Trump's grandfather, Frederick. And I don't think it had any lasting effect. The one lecture I had in college that said we're going to have another pandemic like that, this was back in the 60s, I remember the professor making the point that, you know, once the pandemic was over, nothing really changed. And I don't see human beings changing. I mean, after all, we've had years and years of worsening hurricanes in Florida and the Gulf Coast, and people are still building new houses.
Today, we're speaking with David K. Johnston, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He was a prize-winning reporter, wrote about taxes for the New York Times, and he is the founder and editor-in-chief of DC Report. If you have any questions or comments about everything that's breaking today, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have any questions or comments about the explosive New York Times report about Trump's taxes, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You know, David, it's important to know, obviously, while all of this is happening, we have now over 207,000 people who have died. COVID has hit communities of color very, very hard.
Yes, and if we had followed the science, we might be more like South Korea. If we had the same death rate that they have, we'd have around 2,000 dead Americans at this point. We run something we call the Pandemic Death Tracker every day at DC Report, and we essentially hold Trump accountable for every death above the level of deaths in Korea. So that's 200,000 plus that he's responsible for it. He should be held accountable for
it. What do you mean when you say held accountable? Because other doctors have also said that.
You know, by not following the science, and this is not new science, right? We have understood the transmission of viruses and bacteria since the mid-19th century. What Donald Trump has done is encourage the spread by not providing as quickly as the government could have and reacting as quickly as it could have with ventilators and other material early on, and a host of other actions. What we're really have seen is that Donald Trump just didn't do his job as president of the United States, who, by his own account, his first job is to protect the American people. And furthermore, we know from the taped interviews with Bob Woodward that he knew what he was doing wasn't the right thing to do. That's just really shocking. I mean, it's not shocking to me that Donald says one thing in public and another in private. What's shocking is that now that we know that, people should say, that's just not acceptable. That we're not going to put up with that kind of conduct from a president of the United States.
We have an email from Anthony who says Trump has had easy access to COVID testing with quick results. He has good health care. He'll receive his full salary while he quarantines. He can work from home. The Democratic House majority have passed several bills to provide the same support to people in this country. After agreeing to the CARES Act, the White House and the Republican Senate leadership think it would cost too much to provide the same resources to the people. The lives of poor and working people and people of color are not worth as much as tax cuts for rich people and corporations. This is such an important point, David, because here we are in, what, October 2nd. The extra $600 in unemployment benefits expired in mid-July. So many people are struggling to pay the bills and pay the rent right now.
And this is the day when the airlines have started laying off what will be somewhere north of 40,000 people. And those will include highly paid people like pilots and managers, as well as people at the bottom of the payroll. The coronavirus pandemic has been a very good wake-up call about inequality in America, which has dramatically worsened in Trump's first 2 years in office. And if I can give you a couple of numbers that we just reported last week at DC Report from the newest official government data, it's an analysis I do every year. On the long term, the bottom 90% of Americans, after you adjust for inflation, in 2018 made a grand total of $218 on average more than in 1969. Almost 50 years, and they've gone nowhere. Now, in just the two first years Trump was in office, he keeps bragging if everybody's making more money. The poorest third of taxpayers, that's not the poorest third of Americans, it's the poorest third who have to pay income taxes. Their incomes went down by an average of $300 each. Overall, those 50 million taxpayers' share of the income pie, if you imagine you had one of those pie charts in the newspaper, and here's the slice going to the poorest third of taxpayers. Their slice got thinner. They now have to get by on 1 percentage point less of income. And where did that 1 percentage point go with the pie? Well, it went to the richest 21,000 taxpayers in America. Literally, that's the transfer. It's almost dollar for dollar. Half the increase in income in America under Trump, there has been an increase in income, went to the 1%, and most of that went to the 1/10 of 1%. And this is the result of a whole host of policies we've been documenting at DC Report, where we cover what Trump is doing to our government, not what he tweets, not the palace intrigues. But that's a really accelerating upward change in our government. And for a long time, we have been taking money from the pockets of people in the bottom 75-80%, so up to almost $100,000 a year, and transferring it to the pockets of people who make millions. And some people in America, year after year, literally have a cash income in the billions of dollars.
Mm. David, I mean, where do you see this going? Hearing you talk about this reminds me of a special that NPR ran last weekend. They did an entire hour on hunger. And it really just stops you in your tracks, because they report that 1 in 6 people in the United States could go hungry amid this crisis. 1 in 6.
Listen, some people are going to be very upset by what I'm about to say, but this is a democracy, and we do elect our officials, so it's your own fault. People always say, oh, I'm terribly unhappy with Congress, but I love my congressperson. We have to make much tougher judgments about who we elect to office. And, you know, vast majority of Americans can't name their congressperson if they're randomly stopped on the street. Many of them don't know who their senators are, and that tells you they know nothing about their actual votes and their practices. And we have allowed a campaign finance system that backfired after Watergate. Politicians now are highly dependent on large donors, who most of whom have some large corporate connection to their money. We need to fix that system, and there are various ways to do it. I think, frankly, the best way to do it is every member of Congress and every Senate candidate gets a fixed budget, and it would have to differ from West Texas to metropolitan San Francisco because of markets. But you and your opponent get a budget, that's all you're allowed to spend, and then we'll see how you would treat the taxpayers' money, because it is the taxpayers' money. Right. But however we do it, if you tomorrow, Rose, were told that we're going to appoint you to replace Senator Harris, you might say to yourself, well, I'm going to go to Washington and change the world. No, you're not. You're going to go to Washington and get on the phone every day and beg for money. And it's humiliating, and it's going to compromise what you do, and you're going to sell your soul because of this system the Supreme Court has allowed that equates dollars and free speech. Every one of the founders, the worst among them, would be offended by this if they were alive today. And I can say that because I've spent a lot of time for my law school classes reading documents from that time, old newspapers, letters people wrote, books. Their concept of corruption was very different than ours. They were not particularly interested in personal venality, which we will always have. They were interested in institutional venality. And that's what we are doing in this country. Our Supreme Court has pretty much legalized corruption by bribing lawmakers.
And what will happen when it comes to bribing lawmakers if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed?
Well, I must say, she turns out, when one starts learning what she's written, to be a pretty troubling character. It isn't just that she's completely against abortion, which can be an ethical position if you're rounded about that, about your view of the sanctity of human life. But she's taken a lot of money from an organization that wants to sterilize transgender people. They only want to do it outside the U.S., but so what?
Sterilize?
Press the number. Sterilize, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
What?
Yeah, she, yeah. Yeah, this hasn't gotten wide attention. There's a number of writings that she's done that are rather troubling. And she's only 48 years old. There's a good chance she'll serve on the court for 40 years. And, the Supreme Court's incredibly important to our country. It shapes, it decides what is the law under a decision more than 200 years ago called Marbury v. Madison. And, the Chief Justice of the United States, John Glover Roberts, has every year in his annual report said, we don't have enough judges, we've got too much of a caseload. Well, I think there's an answer to that. We should, the next year, create at least 100 additional district court judges, 50 or 70 or so appellate court judges, and we should expand the Supreme Court to 13 or 15 members. And I had somebody say on a different radio show, well, then we'd have to build a new Supreme Court building. I went, oh, good, a public works project that will create jobs for stonemasons and steel workers and carpenters. I think we can afford a new building, and I'm sure we'll find a use for the existing Supreme Court building.
David, I'm sure a lot of people's jaw dropped when you talked about Amy Coney Barrett and the donation she gave to this organization. Where can we find more information?
No, she got paid by them.
She got paid by them. Okay. I was just kind of so shocked when you said that. Where can we read more about that?
Well, there's a testimony. On YouTube, there's Al Franken, very smart guy, questioning her when she was before the Senate Judiciary Committee for her current judicial appointment. And he wrung some stuff out of her. It's pretty easy to find on YouTube, and it names the organization and the related organization. One paid her, and the other was a subsidiary or affiliate organization. And some of the websites that specialize in legal issues, Lawfare, SCOTUS Blog, things like that, have pretty good pieces about her judicial positions. And I say the one thing I do come away from reading this is that she is not corrupt. I don't like her positions, but she is, as best I can tell, faithful to the positions that she takes. That should be the first order question for any judicial nominee. And then it's a question of, is she in line with the views of the country? And it's very clear that Mitch McConnell, his view has been to pack the existing courts with people who will help maintain the world he wants, and that's a world in which we still haven't resolved the Civil War, in which we restrict the rights of humans and we enhance the rights of corporations. Mm. We need corporations. They're very useful vehicles, but they should be not be our masters. They should be our subordinates, and we should have strict accountability for the senior officers and directors of corporations, just the way the ancient Greeks had strict accountability. If you misbehaved, as my law students learn, in ancient Greece, in your position, your privileged position, the solution to that often was they killed you.
Wow. Well, David, thank you for telling us about Amy Coney Barrett accepting money from this hate group. We just found the exchange with former Senator Al Franken, and we will put a link at yourcallradio.org. We have a couple minutes before we go to break, so let's dive in and talk about this New York Times tax piece. David, you have been covering and writing about Donald Trump's taxes for many, many years. What stood out for you in this piece?
Well, it confirmed what I'd suspected, that Donald paid no taxes in many years. What's astonishing is that he'd already sold most of his real estate. Congress, in a law that Donald Trump lobbied for in 1991, you can find the YouTube video of him, allows families who are seriously into real estate to pay no federal income tax because they can buy a building with only borrowed money. So they have no skin in the game, which is what Trump did. They can even take money out and put it in their pocket. They get to deduct the interest. They get to write down the value of the building that is supposedly declining. And they can wipe out all their other income from whatever else, the stock market, jobs, et cetera. By the way, you can wipe out your income now under Trump's tax law by buying a jet if you're rich enough to buy your own jet. And yet Trump had, in the years in question, very little real estate. He shows these unbelievable losses. I don't know how you lose the kind of money the Times shows he took on his tax returns for golf courses. That raises a terrifying national security question. If those losses aren't real, where did the money go? And we know that Donald Trump was tried twice for tax fraud. I broke that story 4 years ago. It was civil, not criminal tax fraud. But in those two trials, he made up deductions, and in one of the trials, his own tax lawyer testified, that is my signature on the tax return, but I did not prepare that tax return. In other words, Donald Trump forged his own tax return, and he could have been prosecuted. That's a crime to do that. Well, if he did it back then, why wouldn't we think he might have done it now? And if he did fake deductions, who got the money? Considering how much business Donald has done with criminals, mafioso in New York, Irish mobsters, Icelandic mobsters, and especially Russian-speaking mobsters, including a violent felon he had on his close staff at the Trump Organization. You have to wonder whether these Russians got the money. And Russian criminals, the kind that Donald is involved with, are part of what we call the oligarchs. They are the gang of Vladimir Putin, who runs the biggest criminal gang in the world, the biggest, richest criminal gang. They stole the wealth of the old Soviet Union from the people who suffered under the Soviet Union, and they live lavish lifestyles, but they are all part of a criminal gang headed by Vladimir Putin.
We're going to take a quick break. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of several best-selling books, and founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of several bestsellers, including It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America, and founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. Now, I would like to also welcome Michael Kirk to the show. Michael is an award-winning filmmaker and director of the new Frontline documentary, The Choice 2020, Trump versus Biden. It is now available online. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show, and thanks for making yet another great film.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's been interesting to listen to David speaking for the last few minutes. It's a really good show you've got going here.
Oh, well, thank you so much. We actually had to push the text segment up a bit because of all of the COVID news. And so we want to spend a little bit more time talking about taxes before we dive into your film and to also hear David comment. I wonder, Michael, what really stands out for you when it comes to the New York Times investigation and how that's being covered?
Well, it's purely as a person who knows everything I could find out about Trump's personality and actions in the midst of crises moments, I was most interested in how he would, and whether my guess about how he would react to this particular crisis, that is the Times reporting, would be consistent with how he has acted in almost every other case. And I was surprised in some ways on Tuesday night in that craziness that Chris Wallace didn't bore down a little more deeply on that, because I have a feeling that while there was a lot of crazy things going on from the president at that moment, some of them were motivated by what had happened on the front page of the New York Times.
Yeah, that's interesting. And David, you know, whenever we have you on the show, we talk about how the tax system has been changed over the years. And while this is getting so much attention, what about the angle that you have written about for so long, that the tax system really does need to be changed?
Well, the Times stories certainly make clear that what we have is a grotesque system that is weighted in favor of people like Trump. America has two tax systems, separate and unequal. One is for the vast majority of us. We can't get our money until the government gets its taxes, which are withheld by our employer, or in my case, my pension plan. But people like Donald Trump, who own their own private businesses, the government totally trusts them, doesn't trust us one bit, totally trusts them that they will faithfully report their income, only take the deductions they're supposed to, fully pay their taxes, and the only risk they run is being audited. Well, we used to audit about a third of people with million-dollar incomes. We're now down to auditing less than 3%. So if you make $1 million and up, even if you're in that group that makes multiple billions of dollars a year, your odds of being audited are about 1 in 33. And then when you get audited, your tax situation will be so complex that the IRS could miss things right in front of your eyes. I've had auditors tell me this at the IRS. So we really have to have a new tax system. And my next book, the one I put aside when Donald announced, proposes a new tax system that solves all of these issues, requires a much smaller IRS, and make sure that everybody actually pays on the same basis.
And in the documentary, Michael, you really dive into the character of Trump and Biden. You look at their childhoods. I mean, we're learning so much more about Donald Trump's childhood now that his niece Mary Trump is on the cable shows almost nightly now. And we've heard a lot about how he was really shaped by his father. As you report in the film, his overall message was, you know, to the boys, compete, win, be a killer, do what you have to win.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's a very zero-sum game, a way to raise a child, especially your second son. Your first son is the heir apparent. That was not Donald in the beginning. He watched his older brother get essentially destroyed by Fred Trump Sr. Just because he was not a winner. And the object lesson for young Donald, who himself was tempestuous and a little rambunctious and a lot uncontrollable, was if you want to get in the family business and you want to get your hands on all that money and the love of your father, you've got to become what your father decides you should be. And in that sense, Donald Trump started on the road to becoming who he is now.
You also really explore Roy Cohn and Trump's relationship to him. One of the people you interviewed in the documentary said that what he learned from Roy Cohn was never apologize, always attack.
It's such, you know, that some of these lessons that he learned from what the biographer Gwenda Blair identified as School of Dad, School of Roy, and in the future, the School of Norman Vincent Peale, Power of Positive Thinking. The School of Roy was all of those really brutal elements of the Trump playbook that appear all the time. They certainly appeared in great flourishes on Tuesday night. It's just, that's what it is. Never apologize. It's quite opposite from Joe Biden, by the way. Always be aggressive. Call your enemies by funny or terrible names. Anyway, in just every way that you could imagine, by one of the most notorious figures in American legal history, Roy Cohn, Donald Trump had found a kindred spirit, a close ally, and a mentor. And he uses those things so much so that even now people will often hear him lament, where is my Roy Cohn, looking for one today that could help him.
You also write about his first real estate deal in New York. It included a $400 million tax giveaway from the city. Mark Fisher, who wrote a book about Trump, says he got it done by bullying his way through, by pretending to have more backers than he really had, by pretending that he was putting large sums of money into it when he really wasn't, and the con worked. And David, you've also written about this.
Yes, I have. I'm just curious for those listening, for myself, since I missed the show 10 days ago. Is there someplace we can watch it now, Michael?
It's on the, thanks for asking. It's on the, here's the shameless plug. It's on YouTube, Frontline, The Choice 2020, Trump versus Biden. It's also on the PBS.org website. And periodically through October, thank God it's public broadcasting, they run it in prime time, including, I think, the night before the election.
Okay, thank you. Yes, this was Donald's first deal. His father, Fred, was deeply involved with the very corrupt Brooklyn political machine. And when Abe Beame was mayor, he issued an order in which he said, whatever Mr. Trump, meaning young Donald, whatever Mr. Trump wants in this city, he gets. And so Trump got this $400 million tax break, making him one of the biggest welfare kings in America. But, of course, lots of people think he's a genius businessman, not instead somebody who's supping at the public trough with not a large spoon but a big shovel.
The interesting thing about this, too, David, as you well know, is that New York at the time was on the ropes. It was, you know, Ford to New York, drop dead. You know, the famous Daily News headline. Yep. I mean, it was the city itself was really going down. It was somebody told me in the course of making this film, 1 million people had left New York. The manufacturing base in the outer boroughs had essentially disappeared. So at that very time, imagine the audacity of young Donald Trump with some of a lot of his father's money and Roy Cohn's insider maneuvers. Imagine the audacity to come forward and ask for that money, and then whatever sway they had to get it. That's a lesson learned early and practiced often after this moment.
Absolutely.
Michael, given that you have taken such a deep dive into Trump, and then you also are director of the other documentary that's, I think it's almost 4 hours, right? The one Divided?
Yeah. Well, it's there's one Divided States of America, which we did in 16. And then there was the one we did this January called America's Great Divide. So in essence, 8 hours on the great division in America and American politics, seen through the eyes of Washington politics.
I mean, I couldn't stop watching Divided. I had so many notes. I've been sharing so many lines out of that film. I mean, it really gives you so many insights into how we got here. Michael, given that you have spent so much time on these excellent documentaries, when you really sit back and think about this, I mean, it's a huge question, but what stands out for you? So many of us say, how did we get here?
It's taken this long for me to finally recognize how deep the division was, B, how little I understood of it, even though I've been doing this a long, long time. And I mean, what I didn't understand until Donald Trump was elected was the extent to which that bog fire that burns under the surface out there, primarily in middle America, was really heating up, and that the Tea Party was not just a funny anomaly on the side, but a true force that represented something that is now Donald Trump's base and you know the force in Washington, especially as those political figures that were elected to be in the House have migrated from the Tea Party, have migrated to the Senate and other things. I mean, it was all so vast, deep, and driven. First, and David would know about this more than I do, but the anger at George W. Bush by a lot of people, so that when the 2008 crash happened, their anger was that vote on the floor of the House about whether to agree to TARP or not, that anger, that economic anger. So that's class and working class. And then the racism that accompanies the election of a black president.
Right.
When we finished the first go around, I said, well, how do we resolve any of this? How does this get better? And as we watched it through Trump and watched how he fine tuned his use of the base and their feelings, their desires, their needs, because he came sort of generally speaking, not ideology free, but practically speaking, free of any policy choices other than what was given to him by Jeff Sessions and Bannon and Steve Miller and others around immigration and some trade perspectives. Now everything he does, including Tuesday night, is designed, it seems to me, to keep that base alive and well and angry, especially because it feels like he knows he's losing. And now he's got to turn it toward, he took away truth and made that malleable. And now with that base and his own spirited attitudes, he's taken on trust in the American government and the electoral process. That's a pretty formidable thing to be able to do if there's not a massive anger and division out there in America still.
David, what would you add?
Well, I think Michael has hit it right in the head. I mean, I think we are in vastly deeper trouble than you would think from reading our news media. You know, there was an old line in the New York Times newsroom that if a revolution started, we'd find out about it 6 months later. Donald has tapped into the legitimate grievances of the people I talked about earlier, the bottom 90% of Americans who've played by the rules, at least those who have played by the rules, and have seen their economics deteriorate because of government policies. They don't understand those policies. I wrote a series of three books to explain them, but even so, I don't expect most Americans to read, you know, those kinds of books, even though they're written to be understood if you have a high school education. And Donald is not going away, and Donald is not the disease. Donald is the symptom of the disease. We have been stripping a large share of our economy away because our official de facto policy, not that anybody says this, but our official policy for years now is the problem in America is that the rich don't have enough, And when we get the rich more, they will invest and create jobs. And how do we get them more? Well, you know, we take from those people who can't fight back, the children, the disabled, the elderly, the sick, the veterans. Those are the people we take from. And we keep reelecting the people who do this. If you want to rent your government out, which is what a lot of us have done, we have effectively outsourced our citizenship. The people who are running the government effectively or deciding who gets into office, they are mining the public treasury and they are rewriting the government rule book for their benefit. And, if you're not changing that, then, gee, that's too bad. You're going to suffer. That's the point of a democracy. We choose, and we have chosen badly now for 40 years.
That is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of many books, and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. We're also joined by award-winning filmmaker Michael Kirk. He is out with a new Frontline documentary called The Choice 2020, Trump versus Biden. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org, and you can watch the entire film. You can find the links online. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about the media's role in all of this, because Donald Trump is also the product of American pop culture and the media. And in your film, Michael, we see this relationship between the media and Trump. In the 80s, Oprah and so many other people continually asked him if he was going to run for president. Really, just you could kind of feel his ego being boosted as they asked him this question over and over again. And I think it was Dan Balls of the Washington Post who told you that entertainment is an important part of politics and Trump exploited it fully.
He's really one of a kind in my lifetime of covering presidents and politicians, any kind of politician. This is really remarkable how he loses everything in Atlantic City and he gets thrown a lifeline by Mark Burnett, the creator of The Survivor, gets a TV show where even though he's no longer a mogul, he plays one on television. Somebody in the film says that if he could have paid them, he would have paid them to give him this role. He's in American living rooms for 14 years in a fake set, in a fake boardroom, in an empty part of Trump Tower, perfectly lit, acting powerful, acting presidential. He learns every trick in the trade, including he follows audience numbers and what works. And he calls people at NBC, tell us he calls them the morning after a broadcast. And what are the demographic parts? Who watched it? Where were they? What time was it? When did they turn on? When did they turn off? He's been keenly interested in manipulating that, as he was his own image. So, yes, he was as Dan is absolutely right. I've never seen anything like it. The vast difference between what he could do on the campaign trail when he first ran, it was like a scene from The Apprentice coming down the escalator. In fact, they'd shot a scene like that in The Apprentice. It was clear in the beginning he was just having fun and trying to make some money. When it starts to catch on, it's almost like he knows what he's doing and he's having fun with it. You watch him goad the press. You watch him yell at Katie Turr from NBC. You watch him try to keep the red light on the CNN cameras by saying anything that comes into his mind, the more outrageous, the better. And you watch him learn that cable plays along with this. It's worth billions of dollars to Jeff Zucker and others on cable that run the cable outfits. He knew what was happening. And by the way, I think the vast difference is the Trump you would see on the road seeming to be frothing at the mouth and angry in front of his crowds, kind of, it's like they knew and he knew. He was just, there was a little bit of comedy inherent in all this, or show business. Tuesday night was not show business. At least it didn't feel that way to me. He's, and lately, since he's lost control of what he can manipulate by doing press conferences and kind of crazy things, he lost control of that when the virus hits. You can't control a virus. You can control Ted Cruz's career. You can push little Marco around. You can, you know, go after Mueller. You can call it a witch hunt, and you can get your base invigorated, but and the other side completely paranoid and angry. But in this case, with that virus, this virus, he hasn't been able to control it. And then the George Floyd murder and everything that has followed, he can't control that either. That's what that was all about, walking across the street holding that Bible that day after he cleared the protesters away. It was a show of force, but he can't actually control it. And I think it's impacting how he acts both in public and in office.
David K. Johnston, it seems like a lot of this really blindsided the Democrats. In Michael's film, America's Great Divide, Part One, there's an amazing scene. When Trump started talking about Obama's birth certificate, the Obama White House assumed that maybe Fox would talk to him, but this conspiracy theory would not get traction. The exact opposite happened. CNN, Good Morning America, they all had him on talking about birtherism, and they were shocked by it, utterly floored. What would you add, David, when it comes to media and Trump?
Well, Donald is a master at manipulating the conventions of journalism. He understands that if he says something outrageous, we're going to report it. The corrective to that is what George Lakoff at the University of California, Berkeley taught me, who's been very kind in helping me understand some of these things. We need to do what's called, he calls a truth sandwich. You say, reader, listener, viewer, we're about to tell you something Donald Trump said that's just nonsense. It's not true. Then we tell you what he said. Then we correct it and show what the facts are. If you don't do it that way, what people remember is only what he said. And Donald has used, I have a piece up at DC Report right now about Wayne Barrett, the first reporter to get onto Trump, who was exposing Donald as early as 1979. I was the second reporter, and who's dead now. He died the day before Trump took office. And Wayne had these incredible insights into Donald, but when Donald realized that he wasn't a glamour reporter, he wasn't going to write a puff feature, he tried to bully him. That didn't work. Then he tried to bribe him with an apartment in Trump Tower. That didn't work. Donald did similar things with me. He has been very successful in dealing with people who are access journalists and who don't check facts. They have a good story and they go run with it. And, you know, his campaign I've described as a, you know, how everybody slows down and gawks at the car wreck on the other side of the freeway. I mean, we should just keep going, but we do. Well, he just realized that if he hired a marching band and dancing girls, people would really slow down to watch, and that's essentially what he did during his campaign. But because he has no real business skill, no management skill, any business professor teaching leadership could use his show as the how not to do it show. Because of that, he's hidden his reality from a lot of people. And by the way, why would most Americans who teach school, drive trucks, ride around in a police car, or nurses, why would they have any idea how business operates at a high level? They think this is how business operates from watching that show for 14 years. Utter nonsense. But that's what they would think.
Michael, we only have a couple of minutes left. I just wonder, given that we're 32 days now until the election, so much is uncertain at this point. We don't even know, depending on quarantine time, if the debates will continue. They might have to be virtual. But what are your thoughts just in terms of how the media should cover? Ask this question because we don't know what's going to happen with the quarantine. I mean, Trump can't be on the trail for the next 2 weeks. So much uncertainty.
The covering Trump doesn't have anything to do with being on the trail with them. Real reporters, real people are not doing that. I mean, they're reporters and they work for real newspapers and they try and but it's pretty canned. It's pretty pre-programmed. It's not, I mean, unless he says something really odd, which is what you're doing. You're waiting for news to be said from the podium by Donald Trump, who says something strange, and then you can report it, or something scary like the any of the right wing stuff that he might say or might not say. So the real reporting that needs to happen and is happening, I hope, is like the taxes things and other reporting, David's material, other things that are looked at and delivered to the American people. And I suspect, I mean, Steve Bannon told me in this long interview I did with him that, they're not in the persuasion business anymore in campaigns. You know, everybody who's going to vote for Trump is persuaded and everybody who's going to vote for Biden is persuaded. And there's this sort of weird number in the middle. Is it 3%, 11%, 7% that are more or less in play? And what's going to turn the dial, you know, what turns the needle for them? That's really the question. And that's where journalism, which is trying to drill wells all over America and look so that they don't miss the story that happened in 16, which is they basically missed the Rust Belt barrage where Trump went out and got it and Hillary wasn't there doing any of it. And allegedly that turned the election. So that's the difference in the journalism of today. Maybe everybody's out there looking for that and other things, but the real journalism is going to be what's happening right under the surface right now. And a lot of that is aimed at the election, at the truth or falsehood of can you trust the election system? Can you trust those boxes? Can you trust the mails? And what can he do to keep the vote down, or what can he do to diminish the vote? And will Trump, here we are all talking about him again, even though he's in his sickbed, will Trump leave if it's a close election?
Hmm. Michael Kirk is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. He is director of the new Frontline documentary, The Choice 2020, Trump versus Biden, and you can find it online. You can also watch America's Great Divide. It's a two-part film. Find links at yourcallradio.org. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter. We just got a comment from a listener, David, who said people should read all of David's books. So thank you for
that
work.
Very nice.
Yeah.
That's
and David is also founder and editor-in-chief of DCReport.com. Thank you so much, David, as always. We'd love to have you back.
I hope to be back. Take care.
Thank you. You too. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.